Good morning, Chairman.
I was going to have a bit of a crack at you for moving the AGM to Adelaide from Melbourne. Had to get up very early this morning to make the trip, but given the very large turnout here, it looks like it's been a very good decision. I think News Corp got 33 shareholders to their New York AGM and 300 to their Adelaide information meeting, so maybe Adelaide should be renamed the Shareholder Attendance Capital of Australia. I've just got three quick issues I want to raise in the general questions. The CEO is on the record predicting that private equity is going to end up in tears. We've had to give some information to APRA about our private equity exposures. Can you tell us a bit about that? How big are our 10 largest private equity exposures? The annual report talks about playing a big role in the Myer private equity purchase. Are we lining up for a big exposure to Qantas? And you know, just give us a bit of a summation of how big those exposures are, given the CEO's particularly bearish public comments. On the question of APRA, I don't know if this is an unusual view, but it struck me as APRA was ridiculously heavy-handed in the way they responded to the foreign exchange crisis. I mean, this is a $63 billion bank that lost $360 million. And the regulator comes in and starts telling us we have to shut down our trading and crawling all through the business. And it just seemed like a massive overreaction. There was never a question of NAB's solvency or its ability to you know, honour its deposits. Why did APRA go in so hard? Were they just feeling silly that they missed the HIH crash? It just seemed like I've never seen a regulator go in so hard in responding to something that was actually relatively small in the overall context of the NAB business. And just the final question is, for almost 20 years, we always used to describe NAB as Australia's biggest bank. And now, every other day, in terms of market cap, I think CBA's got it this morning after yesterday's 50-cent rise, but last week NAB was the biggest bank. On what measures can we say that NAB is Australia's biggest bank? Like, where are we, the clear number one, and what are the areas where, you know, we have been beaten and we need to lift our game? What are the benchmarks that you look at in that claiming that number one title in Australia? Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Mayne. Well, firstly, as somebody who has to get up early for planes all the time, I sympathise with you. We do think it's important to move around the regions, and it's terrific to see such a large group here today. It's just wonderful. Firstly, on private equity, I'll ask John Stewart to talk to you a little about the bank's position there and our approach to it. With regards APRA, I think it's a bit unfair to say they were heavy-handed. I think APRA was surprised at the event that occurred, and albeit in relatively small in financial terms, it illustrated, I think, some problems in the bank more around the area of culture. And I'm sure that was APRA's main concern, that if you have some cultural issues, for example, a culture where people are reluctant to pass up bad news and try and cover it up and hope that it will go away, that can be a huge problem in any organisation, and particularly in a bank. And so that's why you'll have heard us emphasise over the last couple of years all the efforts that we've been putting in to making sure that the culture of the bank is right, and we're certainly we've achieved a lot in that regard, I think. I think you have to understand APRA's position as a regulator, in which it is charged with pretty heavy responsibilities to make sure that Australia's financial system, in this case the banks and insurance companies, are sound. And as we saw in the collapse of HIH, the implications when a financial institution collapses are much more serious than when another industrial, say, company does, because of the way financial institutions' activities involve so many of the Australian population. And we, I must say, have a really good working relationship with APRA now. We've got real mutual respect because we understand where they're coming from, and I think they appreciate the effort that we've put into making sure these things don't happen again. Your question about the biggest bank is, I think, quite a useful one to make an important point, and that is, you will have heard in the Chief Executive's and my comments today no mention of the concept of being the biggest bank or the biggest anything. For me, the greatest enemy of good shareholder returns is empire building. And once you start talking about an aim of being the biggest bank or the biggest anything in Australia or the world, you lose sight of the fact that what you're really here is to provide good shareholder returns. Frankly, I don't think it matters to our shareholders who are waiting for their dividend check whether we're the biggest bank or the second biggest bank. And so I was interested to hear from you that yesterday the CBA was the biggest and today we may be, because I never even consider it. I don't look at that statistic. It is important, obviously, for us, if we're going to provide good shareholder returns, that we are significant in Australia and in our other regions, in our operations. So, for example, our business bank is the biggest and most efficient and effective, I think, business bank in Australia, and that enables us to give good shareholder returns. But we never set out to be the biggest bank or the biggest business bank or agri-bank as we are. John, you might like to complete that answer on what sort of measures and what particular areas of the bank we're very significant in and where we might increase our involvement, and also the private equity issue.
Of course. Let me take private equity first. As a general rule, private equity is actually quite a good thing because companies from time to time lose the place. The management, perhaps even the board, and the company isn't doing what it should do for its shareholders. The role of private equity companies is to come and take that company private and to do the right thing. Their reward is they then usually make that company public again, they make a profit in doing it, but actually it's quite a good thing for business in general when that has to happen. And that's at the fringe of running businesses, because most businesses in Australia are well run by the boards and by the management. And my comment, Mr. Main, about end up in tears, is because there's almost too much of it. We've now got private equity coming in and they're starting to look at very well run companies. And we see this often in any cycle where things just go too far. And the warning I was putting, and I don't think I'm alone in that, I think there are a lot of voices saying, just be careful, because you asked about our exposure. We don't release our exposure, but let me tell you that we're a big player in private equity, but we don't hold it. So what happens is the days of the banks holding the risk, and then if it goes wrong, it overheats, we take a bath, are gone. NAB Capital, who runs most of this business, runs an originate, warehouse, distribute model. Now, what that means is we originate it from the people who are looking for the finance, we perhaps repackage it, and we sell it to institutions. And we have a relatively small hold. So the bank's exposure, well, firstly, the bank has taken some fees, which shareholders will be very happy about, but the bank's exposure is fairly low to each particular risk, and that risk is out there with institutions. So it's a market in which we participate. We're very cautious. We try to make sure that we aren't on the fringe, but I think it is a market that will probably overheat a bit, and it will go just a bit too far, and then there'll be a correction. So that was behind my warning there. Not to say private equity in itself is bad, just to say it's getting a bit overheated. Now, I think the chairman covered completely our relationship with APRA, and I'll just add my voice to his, that APRA have actually been very helpful to us. And when I first arrived, our relations with our regulators everywhere were dreadful. And our relations with the regulators are excellent. And I know which one I prefer. It's much easier to do business when you get on with your regulator. As for biggest, we really don't have the concept. We are the biggest bank in Australia, but that's not what gets us up in the morning. As the chairman rightly said, is to deliver for you, the shareholders. But to deliver for you, shareholders, we have to look after our customers, our staff, and the community. And because of that, that's how we run the businesses everywhere, whether it's a particularly small business in a country or a very big business in Australia. And we never really go for empire building, and that's not likely to change with this board.
Just a couple of quick points. want to ask how the relationship is going, being so far away from the head office. You know, there's been a number of companies over the years, South Corp, AMP, I think Maine as well, which got in trouble and happened to have chairs in different states from where the CEO was based. Now, it's very unusual to have Perth-based chairman of a Melbourne-based institution, particularly one as large and complex as this. So I'd be interested in hearing from both of you on how the relationship is working and how you deal with the fact that you can't just pop around the corner and have a chat with the chairman about certain issues. How much time are you spending in Melbourne and how's it working out? And my other issue is just Mr. Cheney's workload. He's going to be the next chairman of Woodside Petroleum, which is, you know, $40-50 billion company. He's Chancellor of University in Perth. He's President of the BCA. The ASX corporate governance guidelines say that you shouldn't have someone who's the chair of two companies. And our chairman is going to be the chair of two top 10 companies, which will be unprecedented once it happens, with Charles Goode stepping down at Woodside and you replacing him there. So how are you handling being so far away and being so busy, I guess, is the basis of the question. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Mayne. Shall I start? Yeah. Hand over to you, Chairman. The relationship, I think some years ago, that might have presented a problem. Nowadays, with modern technology, it really isn't a problem. Both the chairman and I have video screens wherever we're working, and we literally talk to each other regularly, but face-to-face. Now, that sounds absurd, but as you can imagine, we're a global company. I travel a lot. I mean, over the last 3 weeks, I've been in the UK and the US, and Michael and I have still been speaking. So it really doesn't matter whether he's in Perth or he's in Melbourne, or he's in London. The main thing is the relationship. And the relationship is very close. We speak regularly, and when he knows everything that's going on in the company, and I'm pleased to tell you, he doesn't meddle. He stays interested, and we talk a lot, but he doesn't try to do my job, which is a lovely relationship. As for the second thing, if I just comment, I'll let the chairman comment, which is that if you want something done, give it to a busy person. Now, I think we're lucky, and quite frankly, to have Michael Cheney as our chairman. And I don't think you'll find any of the senior management who would trade him in for anyone else, regardless of his workload. And the workload isn't in any way apparent to us. If I need to speak to Michael, wherever I am in the world, wherever he is in the world, we speak within a matter of hours. And we will resolve and talk about that issue, and he'll give me some advice. So far, it's not been a problem, and quite frankly, I don't anticipate it'd be a problem. Michael, do you want to comment?
Yeah, thanks, Stephen. I don't think I can add a lot to what John said. It's working extremely well. This helps as well. The BlackBerry is always in your pocket. So if at any time John wants to speak to me or the senior managers, they'll send me an email and I'll see it, and we'll make a call or arrange to make a call at a certain time, or use a video conference. And I spend a lot of time on planes coming back and forwards, which is actually pretty good in giving you some more reading time. But I think there's actually an advantage in being a little remote and letting management get on with the job. They know that I'm there watching over, if you like, and interested, but it also allows me to see things from a distance, and I think that can be quite helpful. But as far as workload goes, I'm not finding it difficult. I'm finding those various involvements very manageable. And if I weren't, I'd make some changes, but at this stage, that's fine. I do finish the Business Council involvement later this year as I take up the Woodside Board, which, of course, is Perth-based.
And Chairman, just a couple of points. I want to pick you up on your comment that a lot of the figures that you see reported in annual reports for executive pay don't ever actually materialise. Now, there's been a number of studies on this. I cite one in particular by Institutional Shareholder Services, which shows that, to the contrary, the vast majority of executive salary figures over the last 3 years printed in major company annual reports have grossly understated the actual benefits that have gone to senior executives. And the cumulative figure across the top 50 companies would be somewhere between $500 million and and $1 billion. So I think it's a bit odd to come here and say the complete reverse, which is what you said.
Well, I'd certainly like to dispute what you've just said, because it's quite misleading. What Mr. Main's referring to is the fact that when an equity instrument is granted to an employee, that is, say you provide a share as part of the remuneration, one share at $40, it's recorded as a $40 benefit. Now, if the executive then, and that's, I think, we would all say a very reasonable way of treating it, because you could give the executive $40 cash and they'd go out and buy a share on the stock market and that'd be the end of the story. What Mr. Main's referring to is that if that's as part of a share scheme, you grant the share to the executive and there's a $40 benefit recorded, and time goes by and the share price goes to $200 and there's no reporting of the $160 increase in that case. And nor should there be. That's something the executive could have bought himself and like all shareholders, enjoyed the benefits. Where it's generally referred to, and the sort of figures that Mr. Main talked about, is in relation to options. When you grant somebody an option over a share, the value that's determined is according to a thing called the Black-Scholes method. And so if I grant an executive an option over a share that has a strike price of $40, that is, the executive has to pay $40 at some time in the next 5 years. The granting of that option is deemed to have a value which is estimated by the Black-Scholes method at a much smaller figure, say $10, and I don't know what it would be today. And so the $10 is then entered as the benefit received by the executive. If the share price falls over the next 5 years, in that case, the executive never exercises the option, and the $10 benefit that he or she is determined or reported to have received turned out not to have been a benefit. But it was nice to have it. It was an opportunity to pay $40 for a share in the next 5 years. If the share price increases to $200 and the executive exercises an option for $40 and receives a benefit of $160, the $160 isn't recorded in the same way that in the earlier illustration the share price increase wasn't reported. Now, that's an entirely reasonable treatment. If, as you know, some companies issue options that are listed on the stock exchange, and you can go and buy that option for $10, and it gives you the right to pay $40 for a share any time in the next 5 years. And there's no doubt what it's cost you is $10. That's the benefit you received if somebody gave it to you, and that's what should be reported. So it's not a valid point that's being made. It is, I think, an entirely reasonable and sensible way of recording remuneration. What I was referring to is a quite different issue, and that is there are performance tests applied to these equity instruments, and that is the company has to perform to a certain level, and if they don't perform, you never even get the option, you never even get the right to exercise. You never receive the performance share if that's what was issued, and that's a quite separate thing.
All right, and just one other point on remuneration. I thought it was very unusual that John Stewart chaired your re-election. Very unusual to have the CEO taking on a role that's normally run by a deputy chair or another senior independent director. And it just struck me, why doesn't NAB have a deputy chair or nominated senior person? There's no apparent succession plan on the board. And if you look at the pay scales, Mr. Chairman, you're on $665 a year, which makes you one of the highest paid chairs in the country, which is, I'm not going to quibble with that, but it's a lot of money. And there's no sort of next senior director, although there are two directors. One is Jeff Thomason on $402,000 and Mr. Williamson on $561,000, but that's for work they're doing sharing subsidiaries. So why is your pay so apparently large compared to other shares of similar sized companies, and why haven't you got that traditional deputy chairman pay and board structure so that, you know, if you are under the proverbial bus, it's pretty clear who's in charge?
Well, firstly, I don't believe the chairman's remuneration in this company is at all out of line with other companies. We do take external advice on that every year, and that's an ongoing process, and it's very much in line. What is unusual in this bank is, in this company, is that some other directors are paid almost as much. And as you say, that's because they've got some special duties as chairman of, in one case, the European Bank, and in another case, the wealth management companies, which are very time-consuming. By the way, the reason Mr. Stewart came up is that he's up on stage, and it's, in terms of facilitating it, it was more sensible. As regards the general question about deputy chairman, it's not a very common practice. There is a thing called senior independent director in some companies, a good practice, I think, that grew up where you have executive chairman, that is, where the chairman's a full-time executive. And then it's sensible to have a non-executive director as senior independent director who can, if you like, chair the independent directors who aren't employees when that's required. We've never seen the need for a deputy chairman. I don't have any doubt that if I went under a bus, the directors would very quickly determine who should be chairman, and life would go on very smoothly.